Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. Harvard and Oxford historian Neil Ferguson is back with us now. Maybe you know his past books and appearances on this show to discuss past books, including Empire, The Ascent of Money, and Civilization, the West and the Rest. Well, his new book is about a descent. It's called The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die. Yikes. He sees the four institutions at the heart of Western society, meaning in the U.S. and Western Europe, all in a state of decline: representative government, the free market, the rule of law, and civil society. So we'll see if he thinks they addressed any of this at the G8 summit yesterday. Those are the countries he's writing about, basically. So you all listen up and see if you think his bleak assessment is warranted. And yes, we'll ask about his apology that's been all over the news for having said recently that John Maynard Keynes didn't care about the future because he was gay and had no kids. Dr. Ferguson, thanks for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back on the show. Do I have to do the apology again?
Well, let's assume you've apologized for the way you put it. But what I'm curious about is you defended the idea still, right, of Keynes not caring about the future.
Well, I think my mistake for which I apologize was to link it to his sexuality. And that was just a stupid thing to say brought on by fatigue. I nevertheless think there's a point about Keynes's thinking which is relevant here, since my book is called The Great Degeneration because it's about what we're doing to future generations. And Keynes, intellectually, nothing to do with his sexuality, just to say that again, intellectually was dismissive of the Victorian assumptions that you needed to be thrifty and you needed to think ahead. He says in the famous essay, Economic Prospects for our Grandchildren, you know, we should aim to live for the moment, live in the present. He's very explicit about that. The famous quote, in the long run, we're all dead, isn't really about that. That was a more technical point he was making about monetary policy, oddly enough. But I think Keynes and the Bloomsbury set of which he was a part did feel that one should live in the present and that deferring gratification was wrong, which was a kind of backlash against the Victorians, understandable, legitimate in the sense that if you're in the midst of a depression, saving for the future makes relatively little sense. But that's not the point that I'm addressing in The Great Degeneration.
But I was reading up a little on Keynes last night, thinking about the remark, and I discovered a work, and, you know, I'm no expert, no historian, no economist, but a work I'm sure you've heard of or have read. In 1931, he published a whole essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren.
That's what I'm just referring to. Right.
So does that cancel out the one remark you quoted about not caring about the morrow?
But did you read it?
I read a review of it.
Read the article. What he says is that we must hope in 100 years from now we have so solved the economic problem, A, that economists will be about as important as dentists, which is a nice line, B, that our grandchildren will be able to live in the here and now, in the present, and not worry about the future.
He certainly was utopian. I mean, he said right. That he hoped the economy was heading to a point where his grandchildren would only have to work 15 hours a week by the year 2030. We're obviously not going in that direction.
Well, of course, we have some people who work no hours a week as a result of becoming permanently unemployed, but I think the argument that I'm trying to make in the Great Degeneration has nothing to do with Keynes. I mean, in fact, he doesn't appear in the book at all. I think the word Keynesian appears once. What I try and do in the book is to say we have exhausted ourselves over the last 5 years arguing, as you often do on this show, about austerity versus stimulus. And then there's a whole other argument about monetary policy, as if a big macro solution exists for all our problems, if only we could make it big enough. And the argument I'm trying to make in The Great Degeneration is that that's wrong, that's not the answer.
But would you say that argument is sort of Keynes versus Milton Friedman writ into politics as Democrat and Republican in this country?
You know, in a cartoon version of the world, like that kind of YouTube video of Keynes v. Hayek as rappers. But, you know, in a serious sense, no, because I think if you ask yourself, what are the policies to pursue to avert a depression, we in fact have done both Keynes and Friedman. So there was a false opposition there. And those options weren't open to every country. I mean, there's not the option to run huge deficits if you already have a huge one and you're the UK or you're Greece. And there's not the option to do Friedmanite monetary policy if you don't control your own monetary policy. Now, that's all, it seems to me, well understood. And much of what's gone on has been a kind of Punch and Judy show, which at times, and I think this was part of the significance of the Keynes row, has been more personal than it's really been about the issues. The real question that the book addresses is how far is the relatively slow growth, or indeed zero growth, that we see in some parts of the West the result of institutional and structural problems that you could never solve with printing money or running a huge deficit?
But when you say that the worst of all these problems that you see is intergenerational inequity because the young are relatively politically powerless, if by that you mean the Social Security and Medicare problem in this country that'll be due all those baby boomers, many economists argue that it's not really a degeneration problem. It's just a math problem, that a few tweaks to Social Security, some bending of the cost curve for health care primarily, which is already beginning to happen, and maybe some Simpson-Bowles-style compromise, which will happen eventually, I suspect, because we have no choice. And then it's certainly not the end of civilization as we know it. It's a math problem. So are you too downbeat?
Well, actually, my book's quite an optimistic book, contrary to what you were leading your listeners to think, because I say these problems are fixable. I'm not predicting the decline and fall of Western civilization a la Oswald Spengler. I'm saying the problems that we face that are holding us back, like the huge fiscal imbalances, are solvable. It's a matter of political will. It's a matter of leadership. Now, if the unfunded liabilities, here's the arithmetical problem you referred to, unfunded liabilities of the federal government, especially Medicare and Social Security, total some kind of present value of $220 trillion, that's quite a big number. And so quite a big fix has to happen. Larry Kotlikoff at Boston University has done the best math on this, and I think he's the most impressive thinker on fiscal issues in the U.S. And his point is that if you really calculate the long-term, indeed infinite time horizon liabilities and long-term infinite time horizon revenues, there is an absolutely huge hole. If you wanted to achieve generational balance, if you wanted to make sure that future generations paid the same kind of taxes and received the same kind of entitlements, you would have to immediately and permanently cut all government spending by about 35% or increase all federal taxes by 65%. So the idea that these are quick fixes is, I think, an illusion. These are incredibly difficult fixes, and any politician who tries to propose really serious fixes finds himself pretty quickly in trouble.
Neil Ferguson, author of The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die. And your analysis in this book goes beyond economics to other aspects of society. For example, you say the rule of law is becoming the rule of lawyers.
This is not an economics book. It's actually a book about political thinking and theory. The rule of law is something we all think is great. Everybody says it's good. But what does it mean in practice? And do we still have the best rule of law in the United States in the world? And the answer is we don't. By any measure, in any of the international studies on the quality of institutions, whether you look at the World Economic Forum or the Canadian Fraser Institute, there's a problem. And the problem takes various forms. There are 22 different measures of institutional quality that the World Economic Forum uses in its Global Competitiveness Index. And the United States is nowhere near the top in the international rankings. It's in some cases quite near the middle. And it's beaten on every single count by Hong Kong, not to mention other English-speaking countries. So what's gone wrong here? I think there are two different things. One is that we have an incredible jungle of legislation, an even bigger jungle of regulation, which creates enormous uncertainties from the point of view, particularly of people running businesses. You actually struggle to know what your liabilities are often because they are so enormously complex. And then you have even when there isn't specific regulation to worry about, the tort law phenomenon, where somebody can come after you through the tort system, which clearly needs reform. I mean, it costs in relative terms three times as much as any equivalent in the UK, despite the common legal origin of the two systems. The rule of lawyers interests me as a concept, partly because I've experienced it. It's one of the things as a
an
immigrant. I've not been sued, but I have encountered the billable hours phenomenon where in trying to find out my situation, I won't go into details, I have been amazed at what American lawyers will demand. I mean, there really is a rather frightening feeling of being, you know, the bleeding animal in the Amazon as the piranhas begin to gather. So I think there's an issue there which doesn't get talked about enough. And yet when you talk about it to people who are running small businesses, they go, absolutely, it's a nightmare. But and by the way, lawyers do dominate our Congress. I mean,
absolutely,
not quite as much as they used to in the 70s, but it's still maybe a quarter of people in the House of Representatives and two-fifths of the Senate. I mean, there is a sense in which the lawyers have an interest as an elite in generating very complex legislation, which then creates business for lawyers.
But is this just the usual conservative politicians or business lobbies lament that our society is too litigious? Because there is another side of that, that maybe some jury awards go overboard here and there. Maybe there are a lot of legal things that business owners have to pay attention to. But essentially, the ability to sue is the rule of law, that corporations can't get away with abuse of customers or workers the way they once could. Even libertarians prefer the tort system over government regulation.
But
because
we have
they
both.
Say it's people on juries. And we have both.
Is
the system really so destructive?
I think it is very destructive. Part of the problem is judges. I mean, judges make some very inconsistent judgments which incentivize frivolous lawsuits. Here's a good example. A medium-sized airline recently found itself being sued by Chicago lawyers in a class action on behalf of business class passengers. Now, the plaintiffs won a free drink voucher because the issue was something to do with the small print on the drinks voucher. You had to fill in a three-page form to get your free drink voucher. The lawyers made $3 million when the airline settled out of court. Now, that kind of stuff goes on in very large forms and in very small forms every day in the United States. And it's one reason why when people look at the different legal systems of, say, the English-speaking world, the U.S. is ranked well below the U.K., it's below Canada, it's below Australia. But you said, as if there's a choice, we prefer this to regulation.
I just said
libertarians
are pro-tort system.
But we live in a nightmare world in which you have both. You know, the number of new regulations since 1993 is about 88,000. 63 different federal departments, commissions, and agencies churn out, you know, 3,000 a year of these things. And it's truly bewildering. Plus, the interesting thing is about all of this, it weighs heavily on the smaller firms. The cost of regulation per employee is 30 to 40% higher if you're employing 20 or fewer people than if you're employing 500 plus. This is a system, and here I want to make it very clear, this is not a specifically conservative argument. It's a bipartisan argument. This is a system which benefits crony capitalism. It benefits the big, too big to fail institutions who can game the system, and it screws the little guy. The problem is that it's the little guy, it's the smallish firms that tend to create the jobs in a successful recovery, in an expansion. That's just not happening right now. Small businesses feel intimidated by the future taxes they think they're going to have to pay, though they don't quite know what they'll be. They're intimidated by the regulation. They're intimidated by the litigation. No wonder the economy is in such a sluggish state.
And is this related to your argument about the decline of free markets? Because, again, I could argue just the opposite. And many other recent books have that nation states are now powerless in comparison to modern unregulatable corporate juggernauts, you know, which has led to our rampant inequality. Unregulated Wall Street adventurism contributed mightily to the financial crisis. Canada, which you mentioned, did not allow the go-go banking system to trade in those exotic securities. So end of the free market, really?
Well, that's not what the book says. And the point I make in the book is that extremely complex regulation, which, by the way, existed in the financial services sector on the eve of the crisis is the disease of which it pretends to be the cure. We think we're regulating finance because we have so many regulators. And by the way, the number of regulators had gone up significantly relative to the number of bank employees. Don't take it from me. Take it from Andrew Haldane of the Bank of England. Both sides of the Atlantic, there were more regulators on the eve of the crisis than there had been in the 1980s. The notion that the crisis was caused by deregulation is a fiction. It's incredibly bad historical argumentation to say that. In reality, there was a massive regulation. It just didn't work. It wasn't applied, or the regulators had been captured by the too-big-to-fail institutions, but there was plenty of regulation. And to think that we are going to solve those problems with an even more complex regulatory network created by Dodd-Frank is to fall into the trap we already fell into. I think the financial system is less stable, not more stable, as a result of the regulations that have been introduced since the crisis. It's a more concentrated system. There's more moral hazard. There are too-big-to-fail institutions, as there were before, etc. So I think we have to be very careful about believing we've made the free market system work better with regulation. In fact, we've made a complex system more complex and more fragile.
Did the G8 deal with any of the underlying problems that you write about at their summit this week, in your opinion?
No. No, not really. I mean, there was a kind of agreement to chase after big corporations to try to get them to pay some tax, but I'm very skeptical about how successful that will be. You know, in the end, these hunts for tax usually just end up hitting middle-sized businesses, and the big guys can always find a way around. The other thing, of course, that they did was to not agree to do anything about Syria. And by the way, I just want to make it clear, the Great Degeneration is not just about the West. It's not just about the US. It's actually about more general questions of how do you do the rule of law in emerging markets? It's a huge problem for China. It's a massive problem in the Middle East. It's all very well to have democracy, but if democracy doesn't have as its foundation the rule of law, or if people come along and say, yeah, we'll have the rule of law, Sharia law, you don't end up with the kind of outcome that we perhaps hoped for.
Is it letting the big companies off the hook, off the tax avoidance hook, to say this will only hurt the small guys if you try to regulate it? We talked about this with some other guests early in the show, this G8 summit decision to try and rein in companies that practice tax avoidance by skipping their bookkeeping headquarters from country to country or whatever, like Apple shielded $100 billion, according to a U.S. Senate report, as you know, by claiming it had no tax residency. So again, who's really on the run here, the free market or civil society's ability to manage the free market? And do you surrender if you don't try to do anything about it because you say the big guys will get away with it anyway?
No, I'm not saying that they should be allowed to get away with it. But I think one problem is that by having an incredibly complex tax code, 9 million words long at the last count, we create any number of ways that the big corporations can play these games. One of the arguments of the book is simplicity beats complexity. We could have a much, much simpler tax code, and we would therefore find it much easier to go after these people. Unfortunately, what we have is a complete labyrinth of systems. They're completely inconsistent over international jurisdictions, and any multinational knows how to play these games. The small firms can't do that because they don't have teams and teams and teams of accountants working on the problem. So the complexity helps the big guys. We need to simplify in order to be effective in taxing, which we should, big corporations.
Do you have an opinion about what Bernanke and the Fed should do today at this meeting that's getting a lot of attention? And world stock markets are very nervous that they might deem the U.S. economy healthy enough now to start pulling back on, you know, flooding the economy with cheap money, letting interest rates go up a little bit. Do you have any opinion on this?
Yes, I do. I mean, part of the point of the book is it's dangerous to think that central banks are the only game in town and that everything hinges on what Ben Bernanke does this afternoon. The fact that we think that is itself very unhealthy.
Well, I think Bernanke thinks that because he thinks gridlock on the legislative side has frozen fiscal policy in place, and so he's the only one who can have any more impact by using monetary policy.
But if the problem's not fiscal and not monetary but actually structural, it shouldn't really matter so much what he does. He's boxed in. I mean, he has created through forward guidance and quantitative easing a kind of trap for himself where he's got to keep on spending $85 billion a month on buying treasuries, otherwise rates go up. And even if he talks about stopping or even buying less, rates go up anyway. That is an extremely difficult situation to be in. I don't envy him because he can't actually end this policy without undoing his one major achievement, which has been to put asset prices and particularly stock prices right back up to where they were in 2007, which, by the way, as your listeners may or may not appreciate, is hugely beneficial as a policy to the 1%, to the wealthy elite who own most of the stock. So, you know, we have to recognize that having monetary policy as the only game in town will certainly get you out of a depression. We avoided the depression, and he deserves credit for that. But if we carry on post-depression, and I think we're clearly out of the depression trap now, if we carry on expecting everything to come from the Oracle Bernanke, I think we will find ourselves fundamentally in the stationary state. This is a concept from Adam Smith, which I think is very illuminating. An economy with enormous debt burden, but one that doesn't grow. Japan got there 20 years ago, still there trying to get out. It's not by any means clear that it will get out. It certainly won't get out purely through monetary policy. The Japanese realize they have to do structural reform. We haven't figured that out yet. And we need structural reform of all sorts. That's really the theme of the book.
And it's been on Bernanke, on one level, a transfer of wealth from the retired who need interest to live on to, as you say, the 1%, to the stock market, which of course they hope will generate jobs and spending and the whole economy.
Right. The portfolio channel theory, which Bernanke set out very explicitly, is the recovery will come by making the portfolios of stocks valuable, more valuable, by restoring asset prices, and the recovery is supposed to come from that. But, you know, we have to recognize that there are unintended or semi-intended consequences of that in terms of equity. There's also, can I come back to the intergenerational point? Yeah, I mean, true, low interest rates hurt retirees. On the other hand, retirees get a lot of other things which the young don't get. Roughly speaking, the consumption of people over 70 is twice that of the consumption of people under 20. Federal and local spending, if you look at all government spending, is double on the elderly what it is on the young. And one of the big themes of the book is we are losing social mobility. We talk a lot about inequality in our American conversation, the 1%, the 47%, you remember all that. But we don't talk enough about social mobility. And I think you can tolerate a certain level of inequality if there's social mobility. That used to be the American deal.
Which, again, the progressives say is going down under the excessively free market system that we have.
Well, it seems to me as much a problem, as I've said already, of the way in which our free market is rigged as the way in which it is free. After all, social mobility is not really about market forces. It's about education. And what we have at the moment is a failing state system of education. You can't blame the market for the fact that public schools suck, which they do in poor areas of this country. If you're born in the wrong zip code, you know, this is not for me, this is a point you know, Charles Murray recently made, your chances of getting into the educational elite are just zero. You will not make it because you will not have a chance at a good college at the end of your high school education if you should complete it.
Before you go, I just want to ask you a question about Canada, which you brought up in, you know, positive terms relative to the United States. And Conrad Black, the Canadian and conservative publisher, was here just yesterday saying he never thought he'd see the day where he said Canada is a better governed economy and democracy than the United States, but he's arrived there. And now it seems that perhaps you have. But if Canada, with its single-payer health system and more restrained capitalism, has less of a debt problem, is that an argument for single payer and other forms of socialism?
Well, Canada has a lot of other things that you didn't mention there. I mean, it has a more aggressive energy policy on a whole range of things, including tar sands, which many American environmentalists are nervous about. Canada has a conservative government. Let's not forget about that. Canada has a rule of law system, which is actually closer to the UK than it is to the US. There are a whole bunch of things about Canada that are different. And one thing is very clear. You cannot have the American Revolution of 1776, and you can do pretty well. Things actually don't turn out that differently in economic and social terms. The issue of healthcare is a hugely complex one. We probably don't have anything like enough time to get into it. The one thing I will say is that the healthcare reform that happened in the United States is very much unfinished business. The problems that will be generated by the Affordable Health Care Act will be enormous. We're only just beginning to see that. There will have to be another healthcare reform. You really couldn't devise a messier system than the United States has. It's incredibly expensive, and the outcomes are very, very mixed, very patchy indeed. So this is still not fixed. I'm not saying we should go the Canadian route. There are actually other systems out there that also work pretty well. In fact, in most of the developed world, the systems are more efficient. You don't have to go down the single-payer route. What we've got is still a mess, and I'm afraid, with all due respect to the president, I know it was a very difficult job, I don't think he really delivered an enduring reform. And unfortunately, in that sense, we're going to have to revisit this in the future.
Do you have a favorite? Because they are mostly more government-oriented than we have had here in the past, right?
I keep thinking that Switzerland is a country we should look at more closely because the Swiss have managed to avoid the great evils of excessive centralization, excessive power at the federal level. They have a system which remains in many ways a free system. It's highly efficient and delivers beautiful outcomes in healthcare terms. So I'm not saying we should turn into Switzerland, and no doubt many of your listeners are saying, but there are all sorts of things that are wrong with Switzerland. All I'm saying is, and this is a big point the book makes, there is best practice out there in institutions, whether you're talking about education or healthcare, rule of law. The institutions really matter, and we need to recognize that ours are no longer anywhere near the best in the world. And not doing anything about that seems like a bad strategy.
Harvard and Oxford economist Neil Ferguson, his brand new book, The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, New York Magazine writer Graham Wood reveals the seamy underbelly of fake reputation building on the Internet. Stay with us.